Then his father came into the room, looking up in surprise to see Ben there.
"Oh, you've come back. I thought you were off to London."
"Just for a meeting," Ben said. "In fact, I have to go away for a few days, up north."
"What on earth would you be doing up north?" his father asked. "I thought you worked in an office."
"Oh, I do, Ben said hastily. "But I've been asked to deliver some papers personally to a research station. You can't be too careful these days. Mail could be intercepted."
"Really? Surely not. The British Post Office is a reliable institution."
"You never know, Dad. German sympathizers are supposed to have infiltrated all over the place."
"That's just scaremonger talk. I believe it's put out by the enemy to drive fear into our hearts, make us suspicious of each other. Think that Germans are landing every day. You know, half the village believes that the poor man whose parachute didn't open was a German spy. Utter rubbish. He was wearing an English soldier's uniform. I saw him myself. A tragic accident, that's what it was."
"Probably," Ben said. "So I'll be gone for a couple of days. Then I may be coming home again. Maybe not, depending on my department head." Reverend Cresswell looked around.
"Now I'm trying to remember what I came in here for. My mind is like a sieve these days. Oh, I know. Book on birds. There's an owl's nest in that big elm, and I rather think it's a screech owl. I caught a glimpse of it at twilight, but I wanted to be sure."
A brilliant idea came to Ben. Miss Gumbel's telescope. He could ask to borrow it for his father.
Perfect.
He packed an overnight suitcase ready for his trip, then cycled over to Farley. As he rode up the drive, he had to pull over to the side while a convoy of army lorries drove past, and the enforced wait brought back his doubts. If he asked Miss Gumbel to borrow her telescope, she'd probably go and get it for him. She wouldn't want him in her room, especially if she had something to hide. But if he went up to her room without her permission and was seen, she'd hear about it and there could be a fuss.
"Damn it," he muttered.
He wasn't cut out to be a spy. He thought of those chaps who were being sent to rescue Margot Sutton from the hands of the Gestapo and how stupid he must have sounded volunteering for such a job. Margot must have nerves of steel to be receiving and delivering radio messages in occupied Paris. He remembered he'd always been a little in awe of her. She was several years older than Pama and sophisticated and glamorous even as a teenager. But surely it had always been Pama who was the brave one, the one who climbed trees and accepted dares. He felt a great wave of relief that it wasn't Pama who was in Paris now, waiting to be rescued, because the chance of a successful rescue from German headquarters in an occupied country must be pretty slim. It was likely that they'd all end up dead. He wondered if Lord and Lady Westrum could have any idea that their child was in such danger, and how difficult it was that everybody had to keep secrets. The last lorry in the convoy passed. Ben continued his ride up to the house. He saw that panels of plywood were being unloaded and carried up the steps, presumably repairs for the roof. The place was busy with soldiers, which enabled him to slip past unnoticed and reach the stable yard. He went up the steps and tapped on the door, just in case she wasn't at lessons with Phoebe. Then he tried the handle and pushed. The room seemed to be locked.
"Damn," he muttered, and put his shoulder to the door.
It swung open, and he was in Miss Gumbel's room. His heart was beating fast as he looked around and saw the telescope lying on top of one of the piles. A radio. That's what he was looking for. And any incriminating papers. The room was tiny, and he went through the piles of books and her few possessions quite quickly. But no sign of a radio. He certainly hadn't seen a radio among her things in the stable room. He wondered if he dared go up to her turret to see if there might be a radio hidden there somewhere. An excuse, that's what he needed. He remembered that he'd been wearing his dinner jacket. Yes, that would work. He went back around to the front steps into the house and up the two flights to the top floor. Nobody stopped him until he came to the spiral stair leading to Miss Gumble's turret. Several soldiers were trying to manoeuvre a sheet of plywood up the narrow stair. One of them turned to see Ben.
"Can I help you with something, sir?" he asked. "As you can see, we're rather occupied up here now, and I'd appreciate it if you went downstairs again." "It's just that I was the one who rescued the lady from that turret room," he said, "and I was wearing my dinner jacket, and I lost one of my gold cufflinks. So I wondered if I might take a quick look. It has rather a sentimental value." The officer nodded. "Of course, sir. Hold up, men. Let the gentleman past."
Ben hurried up the stair. The room was a sorry mess, with plaster lying across the floor and blackened stains on the walls. It still smelled of smoke. Ben picked his way around, examining under the bed, the window seat, looking for any loose floorboards, but found nothing. He was forced to retreat. If she had a radio, either it was well hidden or she'd spirited it away. There was nothing to do but to complete his assignment to the battle sites in the north of England and see if any clue became obvious when he was there. He retrieved his bike and rode home without encountering anyone he knew. Then he walked to the station and caught the train up to London. That afternoon, right after tea, Lady Phoebe slipped out of the house and made her way down to the gamekeeper's lodge. Mrs. Robbins looked like a different person, much older, with hollow eyes and an almost dazed expression.
"He's in there, your ladyship," she said in a flat voice.
"Go on through, if you like." Phoebe had forgotten for the moment that the Robbins's son had been reported missing. She wondered if she should say something but couldn't think of the right thing, so she merely smiled and said,
"Thank you, Mrs. Robbins."
She went into the kitchen and found Alfie eating a piece of bread and jam. He looked up and grinned when he saw her.
"You and I have to talk," she said. "Leave that and come where we can't be overheard."
Alfie followed her outside, and they walked some distance from the cottage before she said,
"We have to get a move on with our sleuthing. There have been developments."
"There have," she nodded.
"You must have heard our house was bombed."
"Yes, I know. Bloomin' awful."
"Well, I've started thinking about our parachutist, you know. Why bomb Farley?"
"Well, there's a ruddy lot of soldiers staying there, you know," he grinned.
"All right, that would be one reason. But what if there was another?"
"Like what?"
"Someone or something at Farley should be destroyed. Do you know Mr. Cresswell, the vicar's son?"
Alfie nodded.
"He was there the night of the fire. He rescued me and my governess. Jolly brave, actually. But he was interested that Miss Gumble had a telescope, and today I was up in the schoolroom, and I happened to look out of the window and saw him going around to the stable yard, which is where Miss Gumble is staying at the moment. So it made me wonder whether he suspects anything funny is going on. Or," and she paused, "whether he might have something to do with that parachuting man himself."
"What do you mean?" Alfie asked.
"I mean, I know he was injured in that plane crash before the war, but why isn't he in the army or something? He's the sort of person who might want the Germans to take over. He's the quiet and sneaky type, just the sort they might use. So I think you and I should get cracking. I know he went to the station, but if he comes back, we need to keep an eye on him. And I'll snoop around the house to see if there is anything suspicious there. You snoop around the village to see if you can come up with anything suspicious. All right?"
"All right," he said. "Although I have been listening to people talking, some of them think that German bloke staying with the doctor might be a spy."
"But he's Jewish and Austrian. He fled from the Nazis."
"So he says." Alfie grinned again. "But I'll do my best. I tell you who I think might be right, Dodgy. Baxter's the builders. Have you noticed the gates to their yard are always shut,
and the fence is so high you can't see in.
Probably so no one can sneak in and steal their supplies, Phoebe said.
Yeah, but it's more than that, Alfie said. I watched Baxter's van drive out the other day, and someone closed the gate the moment the van went through, and young Mr. Baxter was driving and he saw me standing there and he shouted, "What are you staring at? Go on, hop it."
So you'll do some snooping on the Baxter's yard. Excellent, Phoebe said. We'll get to the bottom of this mystery. You'll see, Alfie. We'll surprise them all.
Chapter 29 Paris. Margot sat in the window of the Ritz Hotel and stared out at the street. Her finger still throbbed and welled blood, but it was the other hurt that was more painful. That woman. That is what he had called her. He had looked at her with no emotion on his face at all. She was not his beloved. He didn't care for her at all. She had risked her life by staying on in Paris when she could have been safely at home, and she had never had any chance of saving him. The Germans had been using her, pushing her into a position where she would agree to do their bidding, all for nothing. "What a fool I've been," she thought. She might be going home, but only to aid the enemy. If she didn't, then someone on the spot would surely kill either her or a member of her family. Now that she had actually seen them in action, she was sure that they would have no qualms about dispatching her. She didn't yet know what her assignment would be, but it would presumably have something to do with the fact that she was an aristocrat, that she mixed in the highest circles. She shivered and held her wounded hand up to her breast.
"I must commend you," Herr Dinkslager had said as they drove away from Gestapo headquarters on Avenue Foch. "You were very brave, exactly what I would have expected from one of England's oldest families. I must apologize about your finger. I think you'll find there is no lasting damage. I'm sure you must realize that it was a necessity."
She had said nothing but stared out the window.
"You'll need some training first," Herr Dinkslager said. "So, for the moment, I think we'll leave you at the Ritz. Might as well make the most of the good food and wine, eh?"
He was chatting with her again as if they had been for a drive in the country, not like he had just rammed a wedge under her fingernail. He had been prepared to do the same to the rest of her fingers and to let the young soldier rape her if he thought it might have achieved results. What kind of a man can act like that, she wondered, to behave with a facade of civilization, yet calmly torture and kill? Does he never think about his wife, his children, his sisters at home, and imagine such horrors happening to them? They pulled up in front of the Ritz, and he escorted her inside. Gigi Armand's suite was unoccupied.
"I'll have someone come up with a bandage for that finger," he said, "and I'll arrange for your training to begin tomorrow."
Now she sat there alone, a prisoner, waiting for doom to fall.
"There must be something I can do," she thought.
"A way out over the roof, through the servants' quarters." A ridiculous thought came to her. What if I just opened the door and walked down the hall, down the stairs, into freedom? She crossed the room and opened the door. At the sound, a German soldier standing guard by the stairs turned to stare at her. Not that way, then. She toyed with another thought. She could request something from room service. If a woman delivered it, she could overpower her, tie her up, steal her uniform, and escape that way. The idea was intriguing, but she took it one stage further. If that person struggled and fought back, could she kill her if necessary? Margot shuddered. Killing was different from tying up, but she couldn't just sit here. She picked up the telephone and found that it was dead. At that moment, Gigi Armand walked in. Margot looked up like a guilty child.
"I was trying to order a glass of wine," she said.
Armand smiled.
There is a little man at the front desk who switches on the telephone when he sees me, for security's sake. Now, what was it you wanted?
It doesn't matter, Margot said, moving away.
But of course it does. I heard something about the little incidents this afternoon. Did you have a cognac? So good for steadying the nerves.
Margot shook her head.
But they took care of your poor hand?
She saw the bandage.
So uncivilized of them. I'll tell Spatzi, I mean Herr Dingslager, when I talk to him next. That is not the way he behaves with my protégés, not if he wants a new frock for his wife.
She came across and picked up Margot's bandaged finger.
You must do what they say, ma chérie. We have to play along with them if we want to survive. I gather they want to send you home. Please don't be noble. Do what they ask, and you'll be safe and with your family.
Margot nodded. She had a horrible feeling that she might break down and cry if she opened her mouth to speak. Madame Armand, being kind to her, was a last straw when she had been at the breaking point for hours. Armand picked up the telephone and calmly ordered smoked salmon, a bottle of Chablis, and a large cognac. Then she replaced the receiver and smiled at Margot.
"All will be well," she said.
"How can it?" Margot said bleakly.
Armand came over and put an arm around Margot's shoulder.
"He is very noble, that Gaston of yours. A credit to France."
"What do you mean?"
Margot looked up sharply.
"He let them torture me. Do you call that noble?"
Armand smiled.
"He will not betray the resistance, whatever happens. I heard what he said about you, that you were nothing to him. I know men, ma chérie. I have been with a great many men. He was making sure they left you alone."
"Making sure," Margot said angrily. "He said they could chop me up into little pieces for all he cared."
"But naturally," Armand gave a very Gallic shrug. "Don't you see? That was the only way to let you go. If he did not care one iota about you, then torturing you could have no effect on him. And it also had an added benefit in that it made you agree to do what the German schemers wanted. Now you will be their puppet."
Margot looked up at her suspiciously.
"You seem to know an awful lot. You're working secretly with them, I suppose."
"Darling, I don't work with anybody," Armand said.
"But I am Spatzi's mistress, as I'm sure you've guessed by now. How else do you think I live at the Ritz and come and go as I please? And yes, I confess I was part of that little drama when you were first brought in, but only because I cared about you and wanted you to stay alive."
"Then you'll know what they want me to do in England."
Gigi Armand shrugged.
"Not exactly. I don't expect you will be told until you have contacted the right person over there."
"But they will want to use my position in society to kill somebody, don't you think? Somebody important? A member of the royal family, maybe?"
Armand shrugged again.
"I tell you in all honesty that I do not know. But I do say that you must pretend to go along with them until the very last."
"I never could have saved Gaston, could I?" Margot asked in a small voice.
"Highly unlikely, I admit," Armand answered.
Margot's suspicions were confirmed when she was taken to a shooting range the next day. She had been on pheasant shoots and was actually a good shot, but she tried to appear awkward and clumsy with a gun. Anything to give her time.
"You must do better, Fräulein," the German officer in charge of her said.
"I'm afraid it still hurts me to hold a gun," she said. "You'll have to wait for my finger to heal."
"There is no time to wait," he said. "You are needed over there for an immediate assignment. Now try again. We are not leaving until you have hit the centre of the mark 5 times in a row.
More intense days had followed. More things to be memorized, code words to be understood, and veiled threats made. She would be watched at all times. Her family would be watched. She had no idea how many agents were now working in Britain, but she would be doing a good thing for her countrymen. The conclusion was inevitable. The invasion would happen. But she could speed it along and save Britain from more misery. Then, on the third day, she had just returned from her training, and Gigi was still out at her salon when there was a hammering on the door. She opened it, and 2 strange German officers strode in.
"Fräulein, you will come with us immediately," one said in clipped English. "They have a car waiting."
"Where are we going?" she asked.
"You do not ask questions,"
the man shouted at her, grabbed her arm, and shoved her forward. She walked between them, along the hall and down the stairs. Other German officers passed them and saluted or nodded politely. Outside was a waiting black Mercedes. One of them opened the back door for her.
"Get in!"
She climbed into the back seat. The 2 officers got into the front, and they drove off. Margot swallowed down her fear. Were they going back to Gestapo headquarters on Avenue Foch? Or had they decided she was no use to them after all, and she was being taken to be executed? She tried to stop her knees from trembling. They were driving away from the centre of Paris. Light was fading as they passed through suburbs. So far, nobody had said a word. Then one of the men turned to the other.
"That went rather well, don't you think?"
he asked in upper-class English. The other man turned back to Margot and smiled.
"It's all right. You can relax now. We've passed the first hurdle."
"You're not Germans?" she asked.
"Actually, we're special ops, sent to get you out," he said.
"But the car, the uniforms," she asked,
"belonged to 2 poor chaps who had been drinking at a bar late last night."
"Where are they now?"
"Buried under a log pile."
"Dead?"
"I'm afraid so. It is war, and they wouldn't have hesitated to kill you. Now, there's a dark rug in the back. If we get stopped at a checkpoint, you duck down on the floor with the rug over you, and for God's sake, don't move."
"Where are we going?"
"To the channel, where we hope a speedboat will be waiting. Are you all right?"
"Yes, I'm all right," she said.
"I should think so, living at the Ritz," the other man said.
He had a trace of northern accent, not quite as posh as the one who had first spoken to her.
"Why did they take you there?"
"Gigi Armand was watching over me."
"You're damn lucky you didn't wind up at Gestapo headquarters."
"I've been there a couple of times," she said, and gave an involuntary shudder.
"And come out again? Not many people can say that. You must be worth more to them alive than dead."
"They wanted to use me to get Gaston de Varenne to talk," she said carefully.
"And did he?"
"No."
"Of course not. So it's lucky we came to get you now. Your time was distinctly limited."
They drove on.
"Might I know your names?" Margot asked.
"No names. Safer that way."
Night fell, and they drove through darkness, passing through small towns where there was little sign of life. Then, after about an hour, there was the checkpoint they had feared.
"Get down,"
one of the men hissed. Margot curled as small as she could with the blanket over her. The car came to a halt.
"Your papers, please, Herr Lieutenant,"
a sharp voice demanded. Margot heard the rustle of paper, then,
"What is your mission here?"
One of the men responded in perfect German.
"A message direct from Berlin, to be delivered only to General von Heidenheim in Calais." "The invasion!"
the soldier exclaimed.
"It must be about the invasion." "That is not your business," the driver replied. "Now, let us be on our way." The car picked up speed again. "You can come out now," one of them said, and they both laughed.
"How do you speak such good German?" Margot asked.
"You don't think they'd send a man on a mission like this who didn't? Actually, my mother was Austrian. I grew up speaking both languages." "Jolly useful, as it turned out," the other said. "My German is only from a year at the Heidelberg University, but good enough in a pinch."
They drove on, pausing at a crossroads to consult a map about which route would avoid any more encounters with German forces. Once more, they were halted, but were waved through when the sentry saw their uniforms. Then at last the car bounced off the road and came to a halt among some trees.
"We have to walk from here, I'm afraid," the posh one said. "This is the dodgy part. Here, put on this black jumper, and do exactly what we tell you to. If I say run, you run like hell. Got it?"
Margot nodded. The two men stripped off the German uniforms and left them in the vehicle, then put on similar black turtleneck jerseys. They pulled the turtlenecks up to hide as much of their faces as possible. Margot followed suit. One of the men produced a small flashlight, blacked out so that it only produced a glimmer. It was a cloudy night, and no lights were in evidence. Margot followed them through the woods, stumbling over tree roots and trying to keep up in her impractical shoes. They came to a cottage, but it appeared to be deserted. Nevertheless, they crept past, climbed a fence, and ran across an open field until one of the men held up his hand to halt. Margot smelled salt in the air and heard the hiss and rattle of waves on a stony beach below.
"Now let's just pray the boat has turned up and hasn't been blown out of the water. Should be all right. They are supposed to be using a low, little speedboat, hard to detect."
The man peeled off the covering from his flashlight and sent out several bursts of light into the dark sea. After a moment, they were answered with returning flickers of light.
"Good, they're there, and they've seen us. Now, all we have to do is get down to the beach, cross it without stepping on mines, and climb into the boat. Piece of cake, I'd say." He laughed.
He went to the cliff edge, looked around, then motioned the others to follow him. A narrow path was cut into the chalk, leading down the cliff. They went along cautiously because the path was only a foot wide and strewn with loose rocks that had fallen. Margot kept her hand on the surface of the cliff for reassurance. Farther down the coast, a searchlight beam cut across the sky. Far above came the drone of aircraft, but they were flying high and passed over. "Another bombing raid heading for London," Margot thought. At the bottom of the cliff, they waited. Margot was shivering, but she didn't want the men to see she was frightened. She could make out a dark shape approaching on the sea. There was no sound of a motor, and she realized it was probably being rowed. A figure jumped out and stood in the gentle surf, holding it steady.
"Go, now,"
one of the men whispered in her ear. She ran, stumbling and slithering over the stones on the beach. She reached the boat, waded into the waves, and was hauled on board. One of the men followed, then the other. They pushed off from shore and rowed out again. They were 100 yards or so off the beach when a searchlight strafed the water, picking them up. Shots rang out.
"Get down!"
Margot was pushed to the floor.
"Start the damn motor!" one of the men shouted.
The engine kicked, spluttered, then roared to life. The boat shot forward with incredible power as bullets sprayed into the water around them. Then they were out of range. Cautiously, they sat up again, the shoreline already well behind them. One of her rescuers turned to the other, laughing.
"No trouble at all, eh, chum? Just your average routine rescue from the Gestapo."
And this time, Margot laughed too.
Chapter 30.
Bletchley Park. After 3 days of staring at sheets of printouts, Pamela and Froggy were not getting anywhere and were both frustrated.
"Maybe this is just a wild goose chase," Froggy said.
"I don't think they'd have put us to work on this unless there was some kind of suspicion that it was important. Do you?"
"I don't know."
He picked up a pencil and snapped it in half.
"Maybe they wanted us removed from our old assignments, and this is an easy way of pushing us aside."
Pamela thought of her section leader, who had been annoyed she had solved a puzzle that proved to be important. Had he asked to have her removed, and this was a way of doing it without losing face?
"You know," Pamela said, "we are sure that there are fifth columnists in Britain. What easier way to contact them than through a broadcast everyone can listen to?"
He nodded.
"But we've tried everything, haven't we? No obvious repeated phrases, except for, 'Here is the news,' now a commentary, and now here are some messages from your boys in Germany. And we've gone through all of those messages for what might be codes. We've tried substituting letters, using every third word, every fifth word, and not come up with anything."
Pamela stared at the sheets of paper.
"Maybe there's something we're missing by just seeing the words printed out. What if there is a different inflection in the voice? What if the reader coughs or clears his throat before he delivers a line of importance? What if there is a different reader for something significant?"
His face lit up.
"You might be on to something there. Yes, let's ask them to send us the recordings. It will take a lot longer to listen to everything, but it may be worth it."
This request was met with complications. There was no recording equipment at the listening station, just young WAAF workers with headphones transcribing as they listened.
"If you want to listen in real time, then I'm afraid you'll have to sit with headphones on and take notes," Commander Travis said. "And since the frequencies and hours when they broadcast are not always the same, then you'll be monitoring this between you, almost around the clock. Although they haven't been broadcasting later than midnight or earlier than 6 or 7, so you'll get some sleep. I suggest we send you up to the radio station, Y, for a few days and give this a try. Boring work, I'm afraid. You sit with headphones on and listen to the radio, but the WAAFs up there are skilled at finding times and frequencies, so you won't have to do that part."
"Will we stay up there?" Pamela asked. "Is it far from here?"
"About 6 miles, so we could have you driven back and forth, but I suggest you camp out there for a couple of days until we see how things are progressing. We'll have 2 camp beds sent up with you, so at least you won't have to bunk in with the Air Force ladies." "I'd better put a ring on your finger and make an honest woman of you, since we'll be spending several nights together," Froggy teased as they walked away.
Pamela grinned.
"I think a room full of WAAFs might constitute enough of a chaperone. Besides, I've already been spending the night with a hut full of men, so my reputation is ruined anyway."
"It's dashed difficult not being able to tell anybody anything, isn't it?" Froggy said.
"It is," Pamela nodded. "My family thinks I'm not doing anything of importance."
"Try being a chap and not in uniform," Froggy said. "I get accosted every time I go up to London. I thought of buying one in a second-hand store, and if you tell them you failed the medical, they look at you as a weakling."
Pamela stopped and put her hand up to her mouth.
"Golly, what on earth do I say to my roommate?"
"Say you can't tell her. It's confidential. That's the truth, isn't it?"
Pamela nodded.
When put like that, it sounded important and exciting.
Trixie was going to be furious, Pamela thought. She bumped into her friend that evening when she went home to pack some necessities.
"You're going away again?" Trixie asked.
"Of course not," Pamela said. "They want a couple of us to sleep on camp beds at the big house so we can be available for whenever the boffins need something."
"Lucky you," Trixie said.
At least you'll be at the big house, not in a cold, draughty hut. But a camp bed doesn't sound too inviting, especially if I'm to be summoned at 3 in the morning to bring cups of tea. Well, you won't have the trains going past the window, or Mrs. Entwistle's cooking, Trixie said. That's true, Pamela grinned. But think, you get the room to yourself. One less for the bathroom. That would be ducky if I could find a way to smuggle a chap upstairs, Trixie said. Not that I fancy anyone here. Why couldn't at least one chap have been given brains and looks too? She paused, then turned to Pamela. I say, I hope you can get time off for Jeremy's party. I can't tell you how much I'm looking forward to it. It's the one bright spot in my current life of gloom. I hope so, too. They haven't told me about days off. We'll just have to play it by ear. But they can't expect me to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. That is slave labor. She closed her suitcase. I'll see you in a couple of days, I expect. You wouldn't mind if I went to Jeremy's party if you couldn't go, would you? Trixie asked. Pamela hesitated. Trixie had already made it clear that she was attracted to Jeremy, but it was a party, after all, a flat full of people. Of course not, she said airily. I'll write down the address for you, and I'll try to send a message to let you know how I'm getting along and how long I might be occupied. Then she picked up the suitcase and left. An army car was waiting to take them to the radio receiving station. "Windy Ridge. It hardly sounds inviting, does it?" Froggy said. "One step away from Wuthering Heights." "I don't think there are too many Wuthering Heights in Buckinghamshire," Pamela replied. "We will be in a building, and it is summer." "That's the spirit. A girl who is ready for anything," he said. "I say, I don't suppose you'd like to go out with me when we get an evening off?" She glanced at him. Not bad-looking, especially by Bletchley standards. Good sense of humour. But then she already had Jeremy. Dashing, rich, handsome Jeremy. What more could any girl want? "Thanks awfully," she said, "but I'm afraid I already have a chap. An RAF flyer." "Just my luck," he said. "All the good ones are already taken. Ah, well, probably better if we keep on purely professional terms, what?" The Humber drove up a hill and halted at a barbed wire fence. Beyond it were Nissen huts and aerials. A sentry admitted them, and they were shown into a large room full of WAAFs sitting with headphones on. "It's like a giant telephone exchange, isn't it?" Froggy whispered. An officious female sergeant showed them where they should sit, the supply closet next to the kitchen where they could set up their camp beds. "You might as well get started right away," she said. "No time like the present." Pamela put on the headphones. They felt heavy. She sat, doodled on her pad, and thought about things. The first broadcast came through at 7:30 p.m. A short burst of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, then, "This is your new British broadcasting station, broadcasting on 5,920 kilocycles, 63 meters." Pamela felt a chill run down her spine as she listened to it. How many homes in Britain were tuned in to this, she wondered. There was news of Allied ships sunk, then another voice. "Have you ever given any thought to the fate of your children? You realize that the government's evacuation plan, or should one say their complete collapse, may have a profound effect on your boys and girls in years to come." It went on to say that 400,000 children were receiving no education because of the confusion. Clever, Pamela thought, playing on every parent's deepest fears. A propaganda outburst on the Jewish question followed, then another musical interlude before messages home from boys in prison camps in Germany. The broadcast ended. Another came later that evening, then 4 the next day. "So what do you think?" Froggy asked her. "Any light dawning yet?" Pamela shook her head. "There is nothing, really. Voices rather like the real BBC announcers, lacking any sort of individuality, interspersed with bits of stirring German music. Beethoven, mostly, he agreed. And Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks, wasn't it? Pamela looked up sharply. Could that be something? Royal fireworks? A plot to blow up the royal family? He stared back at her. Now that's a thought. Communicating through music. Dashed clever. Let's make sure we listen carefully to any music tomorrow. Pamela slept fitfully for a few hours, only to be awakened by the early shift coming in to make tea. She washed in cold water and resumed her place at the table. By the end of the day, she was heartily sick of the lies and propaganda. "What do you have?" Froggy asked her. "Beethoven's Fifth," to announce the broadcast. "Different music before the news, commentary and messages from our boys. I'm afraid I'm not well up on music. All German, I assume." "Yes, luckily I come from a musical family," he said. "I studied the cello. My family all played instruments. You might say we had music rammed down our throats. I noted two passages from Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. The messages home were mostly Bach's Brandenburg concertos, but there were two excerpts from Wagner, Ride of the Valkyries and Götterdämmerung." "Impressive," Pamela said. "Now, try and find a meaning to them." "The only one that gives us anything to go on is Handel's Royal Fireworks, isn't it? We should report in that one." "But I can't see any details, know how and when. The piece that followed was about evacuating children. I've pulled that apart and I can't find any hidden message." "And if there was a message, it couldn't be too complicated, could it?" Pamela said. "I mean, then the average German sympathizer couldn't understand it."
"Unless they have code books, and the word child means tomorrow, and the word education means guns."
"But then we'd have no chance of interpreting unless we had the code book. Let's ask Commander Travis if any such books have been captured."
"Good idea." He got up. "Let's call it a day, shall we? My bottom is numb from sitting on a hard seat for hours."
Chapter 31. London. It was pouring hard when Ben arrived back in London, late at night. He had endured 3 fruitless days of crowded trains, uncooperative people, and constant rain. He had seen no terrain that resembled the photograph, nor learned any details of the battles that might have relevance today. He stomped up the steps to his billet at the rooming house on Cromwell Road. It had been an inferior sort of hotel before the war, now requisitioned to house those working for the government. The rooms were Spartan, with bed, wardrobe, table, chair, and a shelf in one corner with sink, cupboard, and gas ring. He had to drop 6 pence into the meter for gas. As he put in his key, the door across the hall opened and Guy's face peeped out.
"God, you look like a drowned rat," he said. "Come on in, I'll make some tea. And I've still got a few drops of brandy to put in it."
"Kind of you, but I really don't," Ben began.
"Don't be a martyr," Guy said. "We don't want you coming down with a chill and not being able to do your work, do we?"
"I'll take off my raincoat first," Ben said. He went into his own room, which felt cold, damp, and unwelcoming, hung the coat up on a peg behind the door, then went across the hall to Guy's room. In contrast, this room felt comfy and lived in. Guy had hung bright curtains at the window. Some of his favourite modern art prints decorated the walls. A plant stood on the windowsill, and there were cushions on the chair. "Guy likes his creature comforts," Ben thought. He sat while Guy made tea, then poured cognac into it.
"Get that down, you. You'll feel better."
Ben drank gratefully.
"I've been soaked all day," he said.
"Where were you?" Guy asked. "In Yorkshire yesterday, and the Welsh border today."
"Doing what, for God's sake?"
"I don't suppose it can hurt to tell you," Ben said. "Checking the site of ancient battles."
"Are you writing a thesis, or was this something to do with actual work?"
"The latter, but I can't tell you what."
"Of course not. Did it prove fruitful?"
"Absolutely bloody waste of time," Ben grinned.
"Most of the things we do are, aren't they?" Guy said. "I was sent out again today to a report of a possible German spy. And, of course, it turned out to be another Jew who has lived here since before the Great War."
Ben nodded.
"But, of course, the real fifth columnists must be damned clever," he said. "They wouldn't stand out in any way. I doubt if I've ever actually met one."
"No?" Guy asked. He grinned.
"I'm pretty sure I have."
"Really? Where?"
"At a meeting I was sent to. But I suppose I can't tell you any more. Captain King would shoot me, or Miss Miller would. She's more formidable than Knight, isn't she?"
"Absolutely," Ben grinned. When he left Guy's room, he felt comfort, and not just from the brandy working its way through his system. He and Guy were working for the same outfit, even if they couldn't tell each other what they were actually doing. That made it easier somehow. The next morning, Ben returned to Dolphin Square to report in and was ushered into the inner sanctum.
"Ah, Cresswell, come in."
Maxwell Knight looked up from his paperwork and held out his hand to Ben.
"Successful trip? Any luck?"
"I'm afraid not, sir," Ben replied. "I visited both the battle sites, and there was nothing in the terrain that resembled the photograph. So I was wondering, isn't this something that aerial reconnaissance at the Air Ministry might be able to help us with?"
"Already sent them a copy of the photograph," Maxwell Knight replied. "No word as yet. They've got bigger fish to fry these days. But you might pop over there yourself and chivvy them up a bit."
"So you don't want me to go back down to Kent?"
"Is there anything else you might hope to accomplish there?"
"Not really, sir." As he said this, he swallowed back frustration. He had been given a plum assignment and not achieved a single bloody thing.
"I suppose the question is whether that particular place was important, whether there was a contact there who was vital to the Jerrys, and if so, will they try to send another messenger or use another format to make contact?"
"Quite," Max Knight nodded.
"And if the time and place weren't important, then they've already sent their message in another way. Pigeon or radio."
"If it weren't important, why risk a parachutist?" Max Knight nodded. Then he cleared his throat.
"Cresswell, there is something you should know. This is strictly between ourselves, you understand. Never to leave this room."
"Yes, sir." Ben felt his pulse quicken.
"I mentioned to you before that we were only interested in the aristocrats in your part of the world. There's a reason for this. You've probably heard that there are several pro-German groups working in Britain."
"Well, yes.
One hears of the Anglo-German Fellowship, and of course the British fascists can't be counted out." "Both relatively harmless. They welcome friendship with Germany in principle. I don't think either group would work actively to bring about a German takeover of Britain. However,"
he paused, tipping his chair back so that it balanced precariously,
"you may also have heard that there is an element of strong pro-German sentiment among the upper classes.
You mentioned before that there are those who would like to see the Duke of Windsor on the throne," Ben said.
"And working to achieve this. We can't be sure yet whether they would go as far as actual assassination of the current royal family, but we are taking precautions, monitoring wherever possible. You see, Cresswell, there is a small, secret group we've only just learned about. They are made up almost exclusively of aristocrats. They call themselves the Ring. Some of them have the misguided belief that they can spare Britain from total destruction by aiding the German invasion.
Some believe a Hitler-style government wouldn't be so bad, that we have deep ties with Germany, including our royal family.
Absolute fools, Ben blurted out. Surely anyone can see that we'd at best be a puppet state with slave labour.
You and I can see that. There are those who can't, or won't. And they are dangerous, Cresswell. There are those among them who still do what it takes.
So how do we root them out and stop them? Ben asked.
Good question. I have my people infiltrating their meetings whenever we get wind of them.
Ben thought for an awful moment that Knight was about to suggest he infiltrate such meetings. This was followed by the thought that he should volunteer for such an assignment.
"Is there any way that I can be helpful, sir?" he asked. "Yes. Keep your eyes and ears open. And for God's sake, let's find out about that bloody photograph," Knight said. "Ask Miss Miller how you get to aerial reconnaissance. They are buried somewhere in the depths of the country. Top-secret hideout, or let them know you are coming."
As Ben went down in the elevator, he had an odd feeling. Why had Knight let him go off on a wild goose chase to Yorkshire and Herefordshire when the photograph was already being analysed by the Air Ministry? And why wait so long to tell him about the ring? He toyed with the idea that he was being kept busy and out of the way for a reason. And he wondered whether the reason was that the dashing Max Knight was part of the secret ring himself. As soon as Ben had left the office, Mr. Knight's secretary, Joan Miller, came in and closed the door behind her.
"You've told him about the ring?"
"Yes. He seemed to find it hard to believe that noble Britons could possibly behave like that. He's a naive chap, I'd say."
"Or a good actor, sir."
Joan Miller held his gaze.
"We can't completely discount that he's working with them. Why volunteer to rush up to Yorkshire when we know they just held a meeting up there?"
"My contacts and my gut tell me he's all right, Joan. But then I have been wrong before. You might mention his name next time you're with them. Suggest him as a possible recruit and see if you get a reaction."
"He's not of their class, sir, and not influential enough. Small fry, they wouldn't be interested."
"If they had a particular job for him to do, they might."
Joan Miller nodded.
"And you didn't tell him that we have Margot Sutton safely back in England?"
"Not yet. I'm uneasy about that one, Joan. The Hell Rescue was too damned easy. I think they were letting her get away. And the question is, why?"
Ben couldn't shake off the feeling of unease as he walked from Dolphin Square to Victoria Station. Was he being used for something? As bait, perhaps? He took the tube to Marylebone Station and then the overground train out to Buckinghamshire. He got out at Marlow and then found he had to wait for a local bus to take him to the village of Medmenham, about 3 miles away. Again, he experienced that feeling of unreality as he looked at the Thames, sparkling beyond Marlowe's spruce little shops. There was even a rowing boat being sculled along the river. Nothing seemed to have changed here. It was amazing that somewhere so close to London could seem unaffected by war. The bus came at last, and he rode through leafy countryside where cows grazed in lush meadows. From the village he followed Joan Miller's directions to a former stately home and had to undergo 3 rounds of security before he was sent to the operations room. The former ballroom was now filled with tables, each one covered in maps. He was surprised to find many of the people poring over the maps were women, young women, many of them dressed in the blue uniform of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. He waited, and a girl in civvies came over to him.
"Hello," she said. "Mr. Cresswell?"
"We were told you were on your way. It's a bit remote, but not bad digs here at all, is it?"
"Not bad at all," he returned her smile. She had a round, pleasant face and bouncy curls, a little like a grown-up Shirley Temple. Curves, but not fat, Ben noted.
"You've come about the photograph?" she asked.
Sorry, we've been overwhelmed recently, and I haven't had too much time to spend on it. It's been all about locating German factory sites and railway goods yards.
Can I get you a cup of tea?
Oh, no, that's not necessary, he started, but she cut him off.
Oh, come on, be a sport. If we have visitors, we're allowed to open the biscuit tin.
All right, then. How could I refuse? They went through to a small kitchen. She poured tea and took down the biscuit tin from the shelf.
Go on, help yourself, she said.
Only if you're allowed to have one too.
Not really, but who's counting?
She flashed a wicked grin again and picked up a bourbon biscuit. Ben took a custard cream.
One of the perks of working here, she said.
We have to entertain visitors. So you haven't had time yet to work on the location of the photograph? He asked.
I've done some preliminary stuff.
The problem is that we don't have many aerial photographs of England, especially not of the remote western bits that aren't crucial to the war effort. So it's working from an ordnance survey map, and that is more tedious going.
We're looking for where the contour lines are close enough together to indicate a steep hill, and which steep hill has a river about a half mile from it and a church on it.
And as soon as I'm getting into it, I get called back because new photos have just come in from Germany.
Is this terribly important?
It could be, he said. I don't know what they told you, but a parachutist, who was almost certainly a German spy, fell to his death in a Kentish field, and the only thing he had in his pockets was this photograph, so we need to know why it mattered.
Oh, golly! How exciting! Of course, I'll do my best. Stay late.
Thank you. It's good of you... He left the query hanging. She smiled.
It's Mavis. Mavis Pugh.
I'm Ben, he replied. Pleased to meet you. He wasn't sure whether he should shake her hand.
Do you work in London? She asked.
Most of the time, yes. They send me out on errands like this. Are you billeted down here?
Not billeted. I live with my mum in Marlow.
Worse luck. She's a nervous sort, so it does rather cramp my style. Do you get up to London ever?
You bet, she said.
The moment we have a day off, I'm up to London on the next train.
Why?
Were you about to ask me out? I was thinking of it. Ben blushed. I'm sorry. I'm not usually so fresh with a girl I've only just met.
Oh, I don't mind at all, she replied. One has to take one's chances in a war like this. We're all so horribly aware of how often one of our RAF pilots doesn't come back. You can be chatting with a bloke one day, and the next you hear he's been shot down. So grab life while you can, that's become my motto.
How about the pictures sometime, then? He asked. Cinema, I mean, not what you're doing here.
I love the pictures, she flashed a smile at him. Clark Gable, he's my favourite.
Do you get any regular days off? He asked.
Not really, but I get quite a few evenings free, when I'm on early shift, like this. It's not that far to pop up to town, is it?
She paused, smiled at him again.
So let's make a date, shall we?
The only thing is, I don't know if I'm supposed to be back at work in London now or still running around the countryside. I'll have to let you know.
You're not giving me the brush off, I hope. Is there someone else?
No, absolutely not. And nobody else.
That's good, then. I must say I rather fancy going out with a chap who is not going to be shot to pieces the next day. Reassuring.
I suppose we should get back to work and take a look at that photo, Ben said. Do you have a telephone at home where I can ring you?
I'd rather you left a message for me at work, she said. My mum is too inquisitive, and she's likely to invite you for tea and then pepper you with embarrassing questions.
She means well, I suppose. She wants to keep me safe when nobody can be kept safe.
All right, give me the work number.
He followed her to her table, and she wrote it down for him. A blown-up copy of his photograph was pinned next to a map. As he bent to look at it, Mavis's name was called.
Mavis, do you have those photos ready yet? The man from the Ministry is here for them.
A large woman wearing sergeant stripes called across the room, giving Ben a disapproving glance.
All ready to go, Mum?
Mavis called back. She turned back to Ben. Just let me hand these over to the bloke from the Ministry, then I'm all yours. Her double meaning was quite clear.